Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you from the Rocky Mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman, CFP. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. Since I will just be making my way back from my cruise to the Caribbean that I talked about in episode 8, I thought it would be interesting to republish a conversation I had back in September of 2023 with Bill Yount and Becky Heptig, the co-hosts of the Catching Up to FI podcast. We had a conversation about what is termed the secure retirement income process, the fund number, and fund buckets. It's an alternative way of thinking about how to draw down your portfolio and have your portfolio last your lifetime. This process was created and coined by Jim Saulnier, the co-host of the Retirement and IRA show, along with Chris Stein, of which I am a huge fan. I thought it would be an interesting conversation to hear for people who may be well-versed in more common retirement drawdown approaches, such as the 4% safe withdrawal rate popular in the FIRE community, Financial Independence Retire Early. This is an alternative to that approach, which I think makes a lot of sense. It is more cash flow based and attempts to address the unsolvable question of how long you will live. It does so by using lifetime secure income, such as Social Security, a pension if you have one, and yes, that unpopular concept of an annuity. More specifically, a single premium immediate annuity, or SPIA. Not necessarily to cover all of your income needs, but at least the base needs that need to be covered for the rest of your life, whether you have income or not. I won't go into any more detail, as you'll hear it all on the podcast. For those of you watching on YouTube, there was no video recorded during this conversation, so you will just see the Catching Up to FI logo during that portion of the podcast. I apologize for that, but back then, they were not recording the podcast with video. Without further ado, here's the Catching Up to FI podcast, episode 39, released on September 24th, 2023.
Welcome to Catching Up to FI, a podcast on mindset, money, and life for late starters of any age on their journey to financial independence. I'm Bill, and I'm a late starter.
I'm Becky, and I'm also a late starter, and we're your hosts. We're here to help you with your journey to financial independence, no matter where you're starting from.
We're going to talk to experts, other late starters, and explore topics related to our mission.
Join us as we catch up to FI together.
Hello, and welcome back to Catching Up to FI. I'm Bill Yount. I've been on holiday while Mark Troutman has been subbing for me in the last few episodes, so you may not have heard my voice in a while, but I'm back. Back with a vengeance to talk about things that are near and dear to Mark and Becky's heart. So let's dive right in, Becky. Tell us who Mark is, even though he's been on the show a couple of times now.
Well, that's right. Mark Troutman of Mark's Money Mind was on episode 12, and that's where Bill and I talked to Mark about money in relationships. And Mark also stood in for Bill as a co-host on our Alaskan cruise when we interviewed Roger Whitney and the Q&A panel from Camp Fi. And you know, Bill, I didn't get the episode numbers in front of me. Those are, what's the last two episodes that have published?
26, 27, something like that.
So you can go find those on your favorite podcast player. So we are talking to Mark again today, but today is going to be a different topic. We are going to dive into an alternative to the 4% rule of thumb. We see a lot of people in different groups that we're a part of asking about drawdown strategy in retirement. And the go-to answer always seems to be the 4% safe withdrawal rate. But we would like to present possibly another way to solve for that question of how much do we need in retirement. So Mark and I are going to go through a different method that we have become aware of and are using ourselves. And Bill is going to be in an interesting position today. He's not really familiar with this, which I think is wonderful because he's going to be sitting in the place of our audience. And if he has a question, it's the same question that you're thinking about while you're listening to your podcast player. So let's jump right in. So welcome back to the show, Mark.
Oh, it's great to be here again. You guys are just killing it with this show, and I love being on every single time.
Well, we enjoy having you. We need all the help we can get, but we've enjoyed some success, actually. We just recently passed 100,000 downloads. So
I know. I saw that. Congrats. That's huge. Really huge.
Thanks to our audience. You know, they're really engaged, and we're enjoying that they're finding actionable tips and encouragement from what we're doing. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's dive back in, Mark. Tell our audience, please, first, what exactly is the 4% rule? Let's start from the basics so that we know where we go into your little bit more complicated math of how to approach retirement differently.
Sure. The 4% rule was originally established by Bill Bengen, who did a study back in the early 90s to determine how much money could you withdraw from a portfolio without it being depleted in a 30-year time frame. And as I recall, the portfolio was basically 50% stock, 50%, I believe it was long-term treasuries or intermediate-term treasuries. And he basically back-tested all the 30-year periods going back to, I think, 1926. So all the 30-year rolling time periods. And what was the highest withdrawal rate, really, that you could use without depleting that portfolio over that 30-year time frame? And his analysis basically came back and said it was like 4.15 or 4.2 was the final answer. And it's always just kind of been rounded to the 4% number. And then people call it a rule. A lot of people now call it a guideline. But basically, that is like the worst case scenario. But in the average of that study, I think was in the 7%. And the highest number was somewhere around 13. So few further studies have been done. There's another study that was done in the late 90s called the Trinity study that came to the same conclusion that, again, 4% is kind of this safe withdrawal rate. You won't run out of money in a 30-year time frame. And in the FIRE community and stuff, there's other people that have done studies like Big Earn from Early Retirement Now has done this huge series of safe withdrawal rates for periods longer than 30 years because some people might have a longer than 30-year runway. And he's come out with 3.25%. Morningstar has said in the current environment, it's more like 3%. So it depends on what you're reading, but somewhere between 3 and 4 is kind of like that absolute. You won't run out of money most likely in your, you know, retirement timeframe. So it's a good kind of rule of thumb. I find it good for those in the accumulation stage just to help them with a target for how much should I save for retirement. But it's not as practical when you get to the actual withdrawal phase and drawdown phase that many of us are finding ourselves in. So we've looked at alternatives to the very simplistic 4% rule.
Well, that's actually a good analogy because I'm still an accumulator. I haven't given this stuff much thought. And the 4% rule does work for me in sort of mental accounting to figure out what do I need to get to. But it's really only an accumulation rule of thumb. We're going to go through, I guess, your rules of thumb or the math, reversing the math and figuring out how can we look at this from a drawdown perspective, something that's not talked about very much in the community. The FIRE community is an accumulator perspective. And what do we do when we get there? Can I ask a question here with regards to, does the Bengen rule account for Social Security at all?
No. So it's basically assuming this is your only source of funds. You're going to live off this portfolio. The other downside is it's very linear. So you're going to spend the same amount of money every year, but just adjusted for inflation, which we know in retirement is not really practical.
So does this portfolio or this approach to portfolio management favor anybody? Is there a population that this works for and what percentage of that population? Or is it something that's more of a myth and we all have to figure it out on our own?
Well, I haven't seen too many people, and I've been in kind of the financial independence community for a long time, and there's very few people that are living solely on their portfolio. They don't have any other kind of income, and they're just literally relying on their portfolio. It's very rare. I've actually never met anyone that really does that. I do that myself, but again, I will have Social Security coming into play at some point in time. And I think you know, it is a good maybe rule of thumb, again, for somebody in their 20s who firmly believes Social Security is not going to be there for me when I retire and I need to do this all on my own. I can't rely on any other resources coming in during retirement. So I think for somebody very young, and it also gives you, you know, the inverse of 4% is 25 times, right? And you hear the 25X rule sometimes. How much do I need to, you know, save? So if you're going to need $50,000 or $40,000 a year, that's 25 times that is $1 million. So it's an easy number to calculate as a goal. So I think it might be beneficial for somebody who's very young and doesn't really have a good grasp on what their Social Security might be. But for people in the Catching Up to Five community, I think many, I would say most, have an idea of what their Social Security is going to be. It's very likely that it will be there, especially once you get into your 50s. It's extremely unlikely that that promised amount is going to be just kind of pulled away from you. And some people in that age group may also even have a pension. And certainly, you know, public workers may have a pension. And so the 4% rule doesn't take any of that into account.
Interesting. You know, I'm 57 now in accumulation for the next 5 or 6 years, and I am counting on Social Security. I know that Becky has that in her plan specifically. She's also in accumulation. She was an accumulator for about 13 years and transitioned about 4 years ago, if I remember correctly. And I want to hear from her about what it's been like to navigate that transition and why she doesn't adhere to the 4% rule.
No, it's interesting because when we're in the accumulation phase, it seems complicated. It seems like there's so many decisions to make. But when I got to drawdown, I realized that accumulation is actually easy. You know, I'm going to oversimplify this, but, you know, VTSAX and chill kind of thing. You know, you pick your index funds and your asset allocation, and then you just keep throwing money at it. When you get to drawdown, there's so many more moving parts, and it's kind of scary. I mean, Mark and I were talking about this morning, when you first get to having to create your own paycheck, you're like, oh, how do I do this? And how much does it need to be? And you start worrying about running out of money before you run out of life. And there's so many things that you have to account for that you really can't predict. And that's the process we're going to talk about today, is called the Secure Retirement Income Process. And when I heard this, it was like, oh, this makes so much sense, because it breaks things into pieces that you can wrap your arms around, rather than looking at the whole portfolio and the whole of the rest of your life and trying to make decisions for that.
Where did you learn about this secure retirement income process? It's not something I'd heard of. You know, I've got the relatively simple Path to Wealth accumulation portfolio, and it's all kind of, for us, unfortunately, lumped into our pre-tax accounts for the most part. We have taxable as well, and we have some Roth, but our largest bucket right now is the pre-tax. And I'm going to have to manage this transition eventually. So I'm looking for answers from you guys. When did you reach the tipping point, and how did you, you know, when did you start transitioning from accumulation to thinking about decumulation, and what transitions did you make in your own portfolio to navigate the preparation phase for the paycheck phase?
So for me, it was initially, my goal was kind of just figure out how much can I withdraw from the portfolio. So of course I came across the 4% rule. I came across that other blogger, Big Earn of Early Retirement Now, who has this, you know, 40-part safe withdrawal series. And I started getting comfortable with that. But then I started listening to this other podcast called The Retirement and IRA Show. And it's focused purely on people who are in the decumulation phase. And the hosts are Jim Saulnier and Chris Stein. And a funny fact, Chris Stein is a professor at CSU, and there were two classes I asked my daughter to take. One was Introduction to Personal Finance, and the other one was Introduction to Financial Planning, and Chris Stein actually taught that class. So, you know, small world, it was kind of interesting. So, of course, I had a place in my heart for listening to this podcast, but the more and more I listened to it, their approach to retirement planning and distribution is completely different than I'd heard anywhere else. And it just made a lot of sense. And certainly, I'm sure we'll go into the details of that, but that's where I heard about it first. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's the only place I've heard it too.
Interesting. Yeah, you just got me started listening to this, and they're two interesting personalities. And I'm at the phase of life where I need to start digging into this. So I'm very excited to hear your thoughts on this process and how you've implemented it, but hopefully with some more granular numbers or percentages where people can understand, I can do this too. I mean, they worry about the accumulation to say you could use $1 million. Let's use the everyman's number. You know, I can get there in 10, 13 years. Okay, so when do I start thinking about it? And how do I think about transitioning from that big pot of $1 million down to, okay, this is how I create different buckets of paycheck and different levels of income and expenses so that I can not run out of money? Because that's what we're all afraid of, right?
Right. So the biggest question is just what you said. The biggest concern for everyone in retirement is running out of money. So their approach is, how do we solve this question that is very difficult to calculate if you don't know when you are going to die? In our other little subgroup, we like to call it end of plan. It's a nicer way of saying when you die. So if you can't, if you knew the day you would end of plan, you could calculate it fairly easily, right? You can do a present value calculation. You can use some assumptions. You can have a pretty good idea of how long this portfolio needs to last, how much you can take out of it, and basically end with, you know, close to zero at the end. Problem is, we don't know how long we're going to live. So how do you solve an equation that has no end date? And that's where their approach differs. So what they do is they basically say, we want to make sure that you have enough money for however long you live to live what they call, they use this term, minimum dignity floor. In our little subgroup that Becky's a part of, we call it kind of base good life, or base, you know, kind of a base life level, not rice and beans, but, you know, maybe it includes, and in their calculation, it includes, you know, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. And transportation would be one car. It also wouldn't be some, you know, very expensive car. It would be a utilitarian vehicle. Food would be, you know, eating at home, not necessarily eating out. Healthcare would be obviously all the healthcare expenses you might have. And housing would be, you know, your housing needs and most likely your current housing, you know, situation and all the associated costs with that, including utilities. So kind of that number. So how do we make sure at least that amount of money is available to us for the rest of our life? In many cases, especially married couples, Social Security may come close to that number. And these are their numbers. They have found that their clients, when they calculate out their kind of minimum dignity floor for a couple, it's usually somewhere in the $60,000 range, maybe $70,000. I actually have calculated my own kind of base good life, which doesn't include excess travel or anything like that. And it came out to almost exactly $60,000. And so for me, for instance, my Social Security will be in the $40,000 range. So Social Security is covering 2/3 of that. And then the question is, how do you cover the other 1/3 or the gap? And there are ways to do it. And here's going to be the really bad word that no one likes to hear, annuity. You can buy an annuity, a lifetime income annuity. And there are certain annuities that, like I call the index funds of annuities, which are single premium immediate annuities. And they're not sold, you know, highly sold by insurance agents because they don't pay a lot of commission, but you can buy them and certainly ask your insurance agent for one of these. But basically, it's just a simple, you put down a lump sum of money and they pay you an annual, it usually comes in the form of a monthly check for as long as you live. And actually, if you do the math on that, it works out to usually in the case of, let's say you take it at age 70, it's somewhere around an 8% withdrawal rate equivalent on those funds, but it's for the rest of your life. And why is it 8% versus something like 4%? How can an insurance company pay that out? It's because of mortality credits. Some people will not live very long. And the people in that pool benefit, the ones that live longer benefit from the ones that have passed away earlier. So the insurance company can still make money. with basically paying out a higher withdrawal rate than you could on your own with your own portfolio. So it's a way to kind of increase the leverage of that portion of your portfolio. So basically you're solving for that, I don't ever want to run out of money. And then once you back that out, Social Security, and if you have to buy a single premium immediate annuity because you don't have enough Social Security, then you can talk about, well, now what else does the portfolio have to do? And in those cases, they're a little bit more identifiable because you don't have this solving for this, I don't know how long I'm going to live situation.
What I've learned in digging into this is actually in the beginning of our lives in our accumulation phase, we're accumulating also disability insurance, life insurance, things to protect our human capital. And we can ladder it so that as we accumulate capital, we don't need as much insurance. And then decumulation is kind of the same thing. You're protecting your financial capital in decumulation from being depleted with insurance products that are actually valid. I mean, people worry about annuity. They think it's a four-letter word. And I've learned that SPIAs, or single premium immediate annuities, are not a four-letter word. They are basically helping you create an income.
They're just a four-letter acronym.
Oh, right.
That's right. And you know what people don't really think about, and I know I didn't until I had this brought to my attention, Social Security is an annuity. I mean, it is a form of an annuity, and it is going to, in fact, is the best annuity that's out there because it's COLA adjusted, and it lasts for the rest of our life. So when we're talking about this minimum dignity floor, these are expenses that will continue whether we have money or not. You're always going to have these expenses. So what we're trying to do is get the younger you to make a promise to the older you that these expenses, these, and like Mark said, you know, we're talking one car, not going out to eat much. And I don't want our audience to get the wrong idea. We're not saying this is the way you need to live. We're just saying we want you to calculate the base of what you need to live, because those expenses need to always be covered, no matter what, for the rest of your life. And so the Social Security, possibly if you have a pension, you know, you add those things together to see how does that compare with what these base expenses are going to be. And an annuity, a SPIA, is just buying yourself more Social Security almost. You're buying yourself income that will last for the rest of your life.
But it's not indexed to inflation, right?
Correct. So that's what I was going to jump in there and say. So Social Security is the best kind of annuity you can get, and you can't buy more Social Security. And if you could, I think most people would say, how do I buy more Social Security with some of my capital? So a single premium immediate annuity, because an insurance company doesn't want to take on this unknown inflation risk, they're often sold as just 0% cost of living adjustment, meaning that that whatever amount that you're going to get paid monthly is never going to change. Or you can buy them with, let's say, a 2%. It's not really a cost of living adjustment because it's not inflation, but just a 2% inflation adjustment. So every year you get 2% more, or 4% or 6%. I don't think they actually go up to 6, but you can buy them with some inflation adjustment, and it's going to be a stated amount. And of course, the more inflation adjustment you buy, the more expensive it will be. So you do have to kind of math that out. But some people will choose to basically keep some money to the side so that they buy, let's say, their first one. And I think of it in terms of whenever you're going to turn on your Social Security, you could combine it with potentially buying a single premium immediate annuity to adjust for that shortfall at that time. And some people will keep money on the side and say, well, I might need to buy another one down the road. And as Chris and Jim have said on their podcast, that usually comes in around the mid-80s in your lifetime that you may need to kind of buy more. I was fortunate to be on a call with Wade Fowle, and I asked him the same question. And he said, frankly, what he has found in his work is that many people's costs actually decrease somewhat because they're just not doing as many things. So it may not be needed. So don't necessarily overbuy at the beginning, but potentially have some capital to the side in case you need to buy a little bit more. And the other reason you might need to buy more down the road is if you're a married couple and you're both receiving Social Security, and then one passes away, obviously that lower Social Security is going to go away. And then that shortfall might be slightly larger. It might not be, but it could be. So you have to kind of think about that situation as well.
So it seems like, well, actually, when do we want to start thinking about buying these things and for what time period? Because there are other annuities that people talk about laddering. There are QLECs, which are delayed annuities where you start receiving payments later and not right away. And then there's also a fixed period annuity that may help you build a bridge to Social Security. It seems like between 60 and 70, you want to find your way there so you can take your Social Security later. Am I thinking about this correctly?
Yes, I think, you know, from the pure mathematical side, it makes sense to delay your Social Security as long as you can, because you get an 8% increase for every year you delay past full retirement age. And obviously, if you claim it before full retirement age, it gets discounted, and that's going to be set in stone for life. So especially in a couple situation, the higher earner in almost all cases that at least I've seen, you want that higher earner to delay till age 70, because whoever lives longer will end up with that delayed amount, whether it's the one who was the number holder, which is what they call it, or the person you were married to who basically steps in those shoes once the first person passes away. The second person, in many cases, it might be claiming at full retirement age, for example, because that payment will end at the end of the life of the first person who deceases. So I found, for me personally, as I kind of ran through this, that it made sense to wait and basically self-fund the delay period. And the delay period is the period before all of your kind of secure lifetime income gets turned on. So for me, my choice is at age 70. So I need to fund my life pre-age 70. And then at that time, that's when I'm going to let my 70-year-old self decide to buy a single premium immediate annuity. I've priced it out now. I know what it will cost for a male living in the state I live in at the age of 70. So I have an understanding of what that will cost and have kind of mentally put that aside. But I'm going to make that decision at that time and not buy it in advance, because maybe I don't make it that long, or maybe something changes significantly where I don't need it, or maybe I need more. So I don't want to necessarily. So once you buy an annuity and annuitize it, it's irrevocable. You can't go back and change your mind. So I want to wait until I really need it to turn on. And a single premium immediate, the word immediate means that it starts paying out within 13 months. I want to make that decision at the time I need that income stream to turn on and not make it today for some future date.
Now, Stephen and I are in our late 60s. I'm taking my Social Security. I started it at my full retirement age. Stephen's waiting until 70. And we're in that same, you know, mindset of we're going to let our 70-year-old selves make that decision, which is only a couple of years away for us. And honestly, today, I still don't know whether I'm going to turn on an annuity or whether I will just keep that money, you know, set aside. I have the money for the annuity set aside. And today I don't know whether I'm going to buy it or not. So we're going to decide that, you know, later. And the decision can be made at, you know, at 70 years old. We may say, let's wait until we're 75 and see what happens. But we have the money set aside to fund it for whenever we decide we do need it, if we do. Mark, let's talk just a second about delay and post-delay. So that's part of Jim and Chris's process, of some terms that they use. Can you define those for us?
Sure. So the delay period, as I kind of, I'll use myself as an example. So I'm single, a widower. And so my delay period is before I turn on this lifetime secure income, which effectively for me is Social Security. I don't have a pension, and potentially buying an immediate annuity, letting my 70-year-old self make that decision at that time. So basically, I need to fund my life, and I am retired. So, and I am 50. Well, I'll be 58 in October. So, boy, I'm getting older. So,
wait, October? I didn't know that. I turned 58 in October. No wonder you're a co-host.
So, it's, you know, a little bit longer than a 12-year period that I basically need to pay for my expenses, not just the minimum dignity floor or the base good life, but everything above that as well. So, you can kind of divide your portfolio into the pre or the delay period, so before you turn on your secure retirement income, and then your post-delay period or the time after. And those are going to be, in essence, it's almost like a stair-step portfolio. It's that portfolio is going to have to carry a lot more weight or a lot more work during the delay period because it's got to fund everything. But then post-delay, it doesn't need to fund as much because you've got a lot of it covered with, you know, secure lifetime income. And so that's where the 4% rule kind of breaks down, because if you were to use the 4% rule, you might be basically spending a lot less than you could early in life. And then find once these earning streams turn on, Social Securities and premium annuity, pension, if you have it, you might have more money than you need if you're living on the 4% rule. So what happens is you're basically depriving yourself of a good life during the delay period until this income turns on, for example. So that's where the 4% rule doesn't really work as well, because it's not taking into account different cash flows that may be coming into the picture. But that's delay period and post-delay period.
Well, that's interesting, because it sounds like you've got to decide when you dunk underwater and hold your breath and make sure you have enough air before you come up to your secure retirement income. How do you solve the math for that? Because, you know, you worry, as I would, that I would spend too much money early and cause inability to recover, even though I get to my secure income. So what does the math like that look for?
So basically what you can do is, and the good thing about the delay period is it's a known time frame, right? So in my case, I'm solving it this today would be solving for an approximate 12-year time frame. I have an understanding of what my kind of base good life is, and I have an understanding of what the extras are, for example. But at the minimum, I know that my base good life, let's just use a number, let's just use that average of $60,000. I need $60,000 a year for 12 years. I don't want to do math on the fly, but what is that? $720,000, right? And, you know, some of that portfolio may grow over time and so forth, but I need $720,000 plus any extra. And we can get into the extra because there's another way to kind of come about that. But let's just say I need to solve for this same kind of base good life minimum dignity floor for the first 12 years. So I need $720,000. Now, Jim and Chris would suggest it be extremely conservatively positioned because you want to make sure that it's there. I don't want to get into the details of how I do it, but I'm not as conservative as maybe they would think, but it's relatively conservative. I do have at least a 5-year runway of, you know, cash needs. That's my personal preference. So I am comfortable with that. But so if we kind of break it down into a hypothetical situation, in this situation, you need $720,000 for this delay period. Now, my delay period is pretty long. A lot of your constituents, their delay period may only be 3 years, right? Let's say they retire at 67 or 65. It may be a 3 to 5 year window. 12 years is a lot to fund. 3 or 5 may not be so tough. And maybe, you know, let's use that same 60,000. Let's say you retire at 67. You only need, you know, $180,000 to get to your secure, you know, your post-delay period. So it's not as big of a funding issue. And then you've got your secure retirement income taken care of post-delay. And maybe it's this SPIA. And I'll give you an example. So I think, and this is off the top of my head, $12,000. Well, let's use $24,000 a year for a single premium immediate annuity for a 70-year-old male in the state I live in is about $300,000. So you would need $300,000 to buy the single premium immediate annuity on top of, you know, your Social Security turning on, plus the, let's say it's a 3-year delay period, $180,000. So that's now you're up to, you know, $480,000 before you can take care of any other stuff. And then we can talk about what the other stuff is. But that's kind of how you math it out initially before you get to the next stages that I'm sure we'll go into?
Well, let's go ahead and talk about that. So you made the comment of the delay period is definable. We know how long it is. We've got at this point, we should have a pretty good idea of what it's going to cost us. So how do we solve for the post-delay period? Because we don't know how long that one's going to go.
Well, that's using that secure lifetime income. So that's going to solve for your, you know, kind of base good life, right? So we've solved that with Social Security and this potential single premium immediate annuity on top if your Social Security isn't enough. So we've solved that piece.
Well, I jumped in earlier and I mentioned a few things that we probably should define. And I mentioned QLACs and fixed period annuities, which are also ways to help solve this problem. It isn't just a SPIA that's out there. Mark, can you define those for us or help us define those? We can walk through it together and then talk about when they might be used as opposed to or in conjunction with a SPIA.
Qualified longevity annuity contract. You're really putting me on the spot here.
Well, I just read this chapter somewhere else. We could maybe bring it up later, but my understanding is that you could buy those when you're younger. You can start them, say, around 76, 80, 85. Right. You can ladder them, and they don't pay you right away. You're planning
right.
for
so it's when a, you... it's a delayed annuity. It's basically an annuity that is not an immediate annuity. It's a delayed income annuity. It turns on, you're committing to it today, but the spigot doesn't turn on until down the road. And with a QLAC, you can use retirement assets in a traditional IRA, for example, to buy them. Personally, I'm not as big of a fan on it because I don't want to commit to something today that I don't know if I'm going to need or want in the future.
Okay, interesting. So not necessarily a recommendation, just, you know, defining some terminology. The other thing I ran across in reading was the fixed period annuity, and people consider that potentially a bridge between, say, 62 and 70, where you turn it on right away, but then it stops. Are there any advantages to looking at an annuity that way? Get yourself to 70 and then let Social Security turn on then?
Well, you could do that. All you're really doing is you're shifting the risk of managing the money from yourself to the insurance company. And the insurance company is basically going to probably give you a relatively conservative rate of return because they're going to invest it in pretty secure assets because they want it to be there. But again, you're solving for a known time frame where you could solve that yourself with a laddered portfolio of CDs or a laddered portfolio of treasury bills and still have full access. Whereas if you were to buy one of those annuities, you've basically given all access to the insurance company and you can't call it back and say, I've changed my mind. So exactly. I think those periods can basically be solved by, you know, laddered CDs, laddered treasuries or what have you.
Interesting. Becky, how did you do it? You guys retired when you were 63, 64, and you're waiting to turn on Social Security at 70 for your husband. How did you solve this bridge period, I guess as we call it, between retirement and turning on Social Security?
We're drawing strictly out of our portfolio. So we create a monthly paycheck for ourselves out of our assets. And one of the things that we're going to get to a little later in this conversation is creating a good life now. You know, Mark mentioned that your spending doesn't stay the same. One of the issues that I have with the 4% rule is it's linear. So in some of the groups that we're in, we talk about the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years. And we are in the go-go years right now, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, one of us could have a health event. We could have an accident and be in a position where we can't do as much as we are now. So we realized that we really want to pull some of our spending forward to today so that we can enjoy life. We can enjoy the assets that we have, but not put our older selves in jeopardy of running out of money, which is really why we're talking about this, because this particular process is the first time I had heard of anything that basically gave me permission to do that now, the calculating your MDF and the SPIA is your younger self giving the older self the promise that your base expenses will always be covered. And this spending process is the older you giving permission to the younger you to spend money, some of your money, at least now, while you can. Why don't we get into some of the other things that your portfolio has to keep track of, or to the jobs that it have? We talked about the MDF or the minimum dignity floor or the base good life, but there's more to it than that. So what other things, Mark, what other jobs does our money have?
Right. So basically, you can think about your portfolio as, you know, the first thing you want to do is take care of your future self, right? So that's either through Social Security or the single premium immediate annuity, or maybe Social Security alone. The second thing you need to do is you need to figure out, how am I going to get to that point? So that's the delay period. And again, I would solve it based on kind of that base good life number, not the what am I spending today with doing all the bells and whistles number. And then the next thing is, you're going to have a couple of other items that you need to think about. One is potentially long-term care. How are you going to solve that piece of the puzzle? Some people just say, I'm going to rely on my family. Others say, I'm like, in my situation, I have a lot of equity in my home and I'm a single person. So if I need to go into a long-term care facility, the home is no longer needed. And that could be sold for, you know, the equity in the home could fund that. So that's kind of my plan. Other people, if they're married, need to have an alternative. If one person needs to go into long-term care, but the other person still needs the housing, you can do that either through long-term care insurance. You could potentially use a reverse mortgage. In many cases, when the first person needs some assistance, they might stay at home and the other spouse might be able to care for that person for a period of time. So that's certainly one thing to figure out. And, you know, how is that going to be funded? The other one to think about is something called aging assistance. So this is not long-term care. This is, I can't cut my grass anymore. I may need some help with the shopping. I need a house cleaner where I used to clean my own house, or I need someone to come in and check on me a couple of days a week. So that's another kind of number to think about. If you want to leave inheritance, some people are adamant about how much they want to leave the next generation or following generations. Personally, I just kind of say there's a lot of contingencies in the plan. There will likely be something left over, and that's the inheritance. It's not a specific number. Others are adamant and say, I want to leave X dollars to these people. And then if that's the case, you need to build that into your plan. And then I find just another one is just kind of an overall contingency number, like a buffer number. You know, for the all the unknowns beyond all of these many things that we've talked about, just having a little extra buffer. And once you've subtracted all of these estimates from your portfolio, you're left, hopefully, with something left over. And that's the amount of money that Becky was talking about, being able to bring forward and deciding, when do you want to spend this excess after you've taken care of all of these other items. And some people will choose not to even include, you know, let's say long-term care, and just say, I'm going to wing it. I don't know that that would be my plan, but some people say, I'm going to do that, or I'm not going to have an inheritance. I'm not worried about that. I'm not going to worry about leaving that. And I'll have a smaller contingency number because I want to enjoy more of the fruits of my labor over the years now. And then that's effectively what Jim and Chris called the fun number. This is the amount of the portfolio that has no strings attached. And literally, you could spend it all early in your retirement. Now, that means you're going to be down to that base good life number for the rest of your life if that's all depleted. But you can decide when and how you want to spend that money and not have to do it each and every year using some strict 4% rule type approach. You can say, hey, you know, we're going to go on that cruise or whatever that we just recently did and enjoy it now. Because when we're 80, if you had an advisor that said, well, we'll see how it goes down the road and see if your portfolio does well, and then tells you at 80, hey, by the way, you know, we're ahead of what we thought. Go ahead and spend it. And say, you know what? I can't go on that cruise anymore. I'm just not capable. So this is a way of kind of figuring out how much excess is there in your portfolio, and hopefully there is some. And if so, then let your current self make the decision on how can I spend that and enjoy life today without jeopardizing my future self.
So this is news to the FIRE community, because they tend to be frugal. They tend not to be spenders. And we hear a lot of stuff going on in the community about, I need to spend more. I need to learn how to spend more because I am an inherent saver. I think you were one of those too, Mark. How have you managed this transition to, okay, I need to pull it forward and spend more in my life now?
Yeah, so I was definitely one of those people. I was living well below the 4% rule because of all the fear of running out of money, which I think is natural for most people that have been savers most of their life, not all of their life in my case, but most of my life. So this was a way to say, you know what? This is a way to kind of figure out, I am okay. I've figured out all of these contingencies. I've mapped out all of these things. And there really is excess. So by doing this exercise of figuring out what is your, as Jim and Chris call it, fun number, how much is there really in excess in your portfolio? And for me, I did have an excess, and it gave me more comfort to say, you know what, I have really, you know, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. I've, you know, accounted for all of these things that potentially I will need money for down the road. And there is some excess. And so it gave me some permission to be a little bit looser with the purse strings. Not crazy, crazy, but, you know, comfortable in spending, where previously I was like, nope, I got to spend as little as possible because you never know what's going to happen, because I never mathed out, well, what does the portfolio really need to cover?
Yeah. So take me through the buckets, because our accumulation bucket is relatively small. How do you allocate these funds for all these different variables in the equation? And how do you invest them appropriately to the risks needed for that bucket?
So, I mean, there's a couple of ways to approach it. One would be to segment each of these items separately and kind of invest them. And again, going back to Jim and Chris, they call it positioning for each one of those items. So for instance, contingency might be down the road. So therefore, it could be maybe a little bit more aggressive. The delay period needs to be very conservative because it's like right here, right now. The long-term care, depending on how you're going to fund it, maybe it's just through paying premiums on long-term care insurance. Aging assistance, hopefully that's further down the road. So that could be invested appropriately. So basically, you're determining the timeline of these goals, and then using those timelines to determine what is the appropriate asset allocation. I don't do that quite myself. I kind of approach it from a total portfolio perspective, kind of using a blended idea of, well, I want to have at least 5 years of cash because that's, you know, right around the corner. I know what that's going to be. And my like 5 year runway of cash is including not just the minimum dignity, but basically my current kind of run rate. I do have this thing called a fun bucket, which is off on the side, which is basically the next 4 years of kind of excess spending of things that aren't really in my kind of standard month-to-month budget. And that is very conservatively positioned because if there's something I want to do, I want to make sure I can, you know, have the money accessible without any market risk or anything. So that's, for me, it's in a long-term, I mean, in a high-yield savings account, for example. So I come at it a little differently. I'm still mathing it out, figuring out what all the buckets need to be. Some people will go, like I said, down the route of literally having not necessarily separate individual accounts for all these things, but probably using a spreadsheet with multiple columns that are, you know, figuring out what, how it needs to be positioned. And I kind of did that. I kind of figured out if I were to kind of invest each of these separately, what would they look like, and then aggregate it. And I found out, you know, that's pretty close to what my, you know, comfortable asset allocation is anyway. So why do I need to go about, you know, actually having separate buckets for all these when my asset allocation literally is very similar to the aggregated asset allocation of what each one of these buckets would be? So for me, I'm comfortable with that.
Can you take me a little bit down the granular path there? Because you've worked out that our minimum dignity floor is $60,000 a year. You were living at that. So what, you know, what are the elements of your asset allocation, given that it all jived with your separating them into buckets?
Yeah, again, I just kind of come to an asset allocation I'm comfortable with. For me, it worked out too. Like if I were actually to kind of do it from a bottoms up perspective, it was somewhere in the 70 to 75% equity, the rest being in kind of fixed income. That's approximately where I am. I don't like to really get into the details of my own personal portfolio because that's me personally, and it's not necessarily reflective of what anyone else would want to do, but it's, you know, I look at it from my comfort level as well. And then, you know, given, you know, what is in my portfolio and what the dividends and interest are, and I know what that is relative to what my spend rate is. So, you know, a lot of people kind of forget about that aspect, that if you, your portfolio is likely going to be generating dividends and income. And in the retirement phase that I'm in, I don't reinvest those. I have those just continually coming into the portfolio in the form of cash. And that does help kind of replenish the five-year bucket as that money is being spent. So for me, that's how I did it. Again, I think it is a good exercise to kind of do the bottoms up approach of what would each one of these buckets be. And maybe some people say, I'm literally going to have separate buckets, but you probably aren't going to have 10 different accounts across three different tax buckets, like traditional Roth and taxable times how many buckets. That would be 18 accounts. Most people are not going to do it that way. Most people would use some kind of spreadsheet and say, well, this position in this portfolio is for that, and this position in this portfolio is for that, and that kind of thing.
Becky, how do you do it?
We ended up in about the same place as Mark. We took the different pieces that we needed to cover. And, you know, I think I'm going to just talk through them. We've mentioned all these, but I'm going to say them again so that if folks are trying to follow this and maybe taking notes even, that they don't have to keep rewinding to hear all of them. So we had the minimum dignity floor, the aging assistance, which was the cost of help around the house kind of thing. We had the long-term care, a guaranteed inheritance, if that's your choice, a contingency fund, the money for a possible future income annuity, and the fund number. So that's the pieces to this plan. And Stephen and I did the same kind of thing. We went through each one. Like, we can't buy long-term care insurance. Both of us have had a health event and we do not qualify anymore. So we've had to make a decision about how we want to fund that for the first person. For the second of us, it would be like Mark was talking about, we'll use the equity in the home. When the first person needs assistance, we would probably do that at home as long as we can, and then either just use our portfolio or a reverse mortgage possibly to fund that. But we went through and decided, you know, in the contingency fund, for example, hopefully most of that money we wouldn't need for years, but we might need some of it sooner. So that could be mostly aggressively invested, but maybe a percentage of it in something that is, you know, cash equivalent. So we broke all those buckets into the time frame where we thought we needed the money and then aggregated it back. And like Mark said, it actually came back very close to what we had already. I'm kind of a visual black and white person, so I haven't done this yet, but I've literally been thinking of taking my Vanguard accounts and splitting them into different accounts. And actually labeling it, you know, this is aging assistance, this is contingency, so that when I look at my Vanguard dashboard, I can see how much money is in each one of those. But that's me, you know, that's me personally.
Well, that's me too, because you go from sinking funds to filling funds. And
yes. There you go. It's kind of the sinking fund.
This is the reverse of the sinking fund.
Mm-hmm. And true. Some people might do it with simply a position in the portfolio. So let's say, hypothetically again, that you felt that you needed a 60-40 portfolio for this particular item, whichever one it is. You could literally buy a balanced index fund for that position. And then you know in that portfolio, that position is for that goal. So you could do it with just positions in the portfolio if you chose to. or say a combination like these two positions are for that goal. So you could do it without actually having to break up the portfolio itself. And that's kind of in a way how I do it. I kind of view certain positions as that's funding that goal.
Interesting. So within the same account, different funds that meet your risk assessment for what that money is earmarked for.
I'm going to try the spreadsheet approach first and see if that works for me. And if not, then I'll like literally break. But
as far as the long-term care and the healthcare, we all stumble and fumble across this. I've heard, and maybe you guys do or don't know about this, and this may be a question we have to come back to, but there are hybrid long-term care policies. Mark, do you know anything about these?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about them. I know on their show and some other shows, I've listened to them, and it was something that I've been meaning to look more into. But I do know that that is a way. I believe there's a lower underwriting requirement with those. So some people that may not be able to qualify for a straight long-term care policy may be able to get it through a hybrid policy. And I think some people have used it from that standpoint. I like to look at products that are specific for one thing and not products that try to, you know, meet two goals. So the, you know, the hybrid policy is both a life insurance policy and a long-term care policy. But I think it does solve the question of people saying, I don't want to buy this long-term care policy if I never need it. That's just money down the drain. So I think that the hybrid policies came out to address that. So people said, well, it's one or the other or a combination of both. It's not like you bought this long-term care policy that you may never use. So I think that was the market addressing a concern that people had. And again, I just haven't done enough research on it to know a lot about them.
Well, I like what you guys bring up with regards to how you approach long-term care and how it's so different for a couple versus a widower or a single person. Your home equity is a resource that you can and probably absolutely should tap if it's only you. The challenge becomes when it's a duo. And in Becky and Steven's case, they're going to use their human capital to cover long-term care as long as they possibly can, and maybe with in-house resources as well to avoid ever going into the proverbial nursing home or full-time care. There's so many ways to skin this cat, but this is, other than running out of money, this is the one that, you know, I lose sleep over potentially is, you know, how do you age in place? Becky, do you have any thoughts there?
Our approach to it is to use the, like you said, the human capital. I mean, if whichever Stephen or I that needs help first, we're assuming the other person is going to have at least enough health to start that care process. I cared for my mother in my home for many, many years. We have three adult children that saw me do that. So that's normal for them. I hope to not have to put that burden on them, but they've already told me that, you know, if we, when we get to the point where we need help, that they are willing to do that. So we're going to try to age in place as long as that is possible. And then, like I said, at that point, if one of us does need to go into a facility, then we'll either just use our assets in our portfolio if we have enough there for that, or we could do, I don't want to do this, but we could do a reverse mortgage.
Yeah, that's kind of a last resort. Mm-hmm. Interesting for me, and I think this is very typical for sandwich generations, Gen X and boomers. My mother, as far as I know, has no plan. She is aging in place. She's still independent. She's 85 years old. And someday she's going to fall and break her hip and all hell will break loose. Mm-hmm. But until then, we don't have a plan. I'm a physician. I'm an emergency physician. I see this every day in the emergency department. Somebody falls or gets an acute illness and all of a sudden there's no plan. And when you have no plan, you go to the ER. And then we're supposed to figure it out, but we actually don't have the resources largely to help you figure it out. It needs to be figured out in advance like you guys are doing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people think, oh, well, Medicare will pay for this, and it doesn't. So it will pay for certain things if you were injured and you are in for a facility as a result of an injury, but it will not pay for long-term care. So I think a lot of people are not aware of that. And I would also say that if I were to, let's say, relocate and sell my house, I would then take some of that equity and then put it to the side for that potential eventuality, especially if I became a renter, for example, and I had no home equity. So that is my plan if I downsize or if I feel like the home equity wouldn't cover that cost.
And I agree with that. You know, that's something that we've thought about too, is while we are still both alive, but in, say, the slow go or the no go years, we might not need the size home that we have now. And it's, I mean, I'd like to stay in the home I'm in now, but it has stairs everywhere. So that might not be possible. And so some of that home equity may be extracted while we're both still alive.
We've gotten a little somber. It feels a little, the mood feels a little gloomy in the room here because we're talking about end of plan.
Let's talk about fun then.
Yes. Perfect segue, Mark. How did you know? I'm going for the fun number. Can you guys tell us, you know, when you calculated the numbers, what percent of your portfolio actually ended up being surprisingly probably your fun number? And how empowering was that to do with the things you're doing now? And please tell us what you're doing now.
Yeah. So for me, it ended up being, I was a super saver. So it ended up being a sizable percentage of the portfolio, much larger than I expected. And I think that's what gave me the confidence to be able to spend. And I think it really is an individual thing. So some people, and it's interesting, I believe Jim and Chris, when they first went through this exercise, and I think it was a 5-podcast episode, they used a number, I want to say, and Becky would probably remember, it was somewhere in the $2 million, maybe even $2.5 million range. Mm-hmm. And they got a lot of pushback, like, hey, most people don't have that. You need to do one for a sub $1 million portfolio. And they did that. They ended up doing that and basically saying there just isn't as much money to do all of these things that you may want to do. And you just have to be realistic. And in some cases, I think maybe they cut the contingency amount down, or they may have said, well, you know, aging assistance is going to be lower, or long-term care needs to be in home. And some people even said, well, Medicaid will be my long-term care plan if I run out of money. And for some people, that may be part of the plan because of necessity. So for me, it ended up being a larger number than I expected. So again, it's allowing me to be more comfortable with my fun bucket, which I already had established, and also the ability to replenish that fun bucket when and if, most likely when, it is depleted over a short period of time. So there is comfort in that I will be able to refill that without issue.
What kind of fun are you having, man?
Oh, well, we did just do the Alaska trip. That was a big deal. And then I do a lot of Camp Fives, for example, and I do a whole bunch of kind of financial independence meetups and things, and they're all over the country. And I know Becky and I have a couple more cruises actually planned for next year. I think we just booked, what, 3 of them in the last week or so.
Well, I haven't heard about these. I need to hear about these. Where are you going? So,
let's see. With this other group, it's called Fin Talks with Amberly Grant. I think you know
We talked to Amberly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, she's doing one for all of our youngins. So I like to call them the kids. So we're going to Mexico for 5 days in January. And then Becky and I and Steven are doing a 9-day cruise to the Eastern Caribbean. So like St. Thomas and Grenada, and where else are we going? Antigua, I think. So that's in April. And then Katie and I, actually, my daughter's name is Katie. She and I booked a cruise to the Mediterranean when we were on our last cruise, because you get a discount when you book on board for your next cruise. So that's in... Let's see.
You can save more by spending more.
Right. August and September, and it's going to Croatia. And my mom put her hand up and said, I want to go. So she's going. And then I told Becky and Steven, and they were like, well, we want to go. So they're joining us on that one. So 24 is starting to be filled up.
This is the year. Well,
I've been to Croatia. So any tips you need, let me know. It's a fabulous country, one of the best trips we've ever been on. So yeah. I have just heard now that Becky's going. I am never ceased to be amazed how Becky's been able to take starting at 50 with a net worth of 0, retiring at 63 with her present net worth, and then living a life that I didn't dream possible on where she was able to get to. She tells everybody it's possible, right, Becky?
It is. We, you know, when we first retired, we hadn't heard any of this information. In fact, I'm not even sure if we'd heard of the 4% rule. So we just tried to come up with a number that we were comfortable with, that we thought, well, hopefully we won't run out of money before we run out of life. But we've got so many more tools now to do this planning with. And I do have to say, there are times when I'm like, is this right? Is this going to work? You know, it's like somebody will ask me about it and I'm saying, well, come ask me in 20 years. I'll tell you whether or not it's worked. But it just makes sense. I mean, we went through this process. We took our portfolio. And in our case, as long as both of us are still alive, our Social Security is going to cover our minimum dignity floor. Now, it may not stay that way forever because of inflation pressures. But again, that's why we have money set aside for a SPIA. So we took our portfolio and broke it up into the what we needed for the delay period, and then what we needed for MDF, and discovered that Social Security is going to cover it at the beginning. We put in our aging assistance. We aren't going to do a guaranteed inheritance. If there's something left, the kids get it. And if there's not, well, then there's not. In the contingency and the possible future SPIA, and came up with our fund number. And for us, it's like literally almost 30% of our portfolio. Now, we did put a decent contingency in there just because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. And we also don't know yet if we're going to buy the SPIA. But it has given me I'm not going to go crazy with this, but it's given me the comfort to spend money. I mean, when Mark said he was going to Croatia, at first I was like, oh, well, gosh, that sounds great, but have fun because I can't go. And the more Stephen and I talked, it's like, you know, we've run the numbers. We're confident that the plan is stable. So it's like, yeah, let's do this because we don't know how long our go-go period is going to be. I mean, it could be another 10 years, or it could be another 2 weeks. We just don't know because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So we went through this thought process literally because I kind of needed some comfort in the fact that it was okay to add this trip to the list we've already accumulated. And I said, okay, what's the worst thing that'll happen is that we have a much longer go-go period than we expect, and we get to the end of the go-go period and we don't have money for these kinds of trips. But we say, well, okay, then this year's vacation is going to be, you know, we're going to drive to Durango instead of go on an 11-day cruise.
You can visit my son and tell him hello for me when you're out there.
There you go. We could. So, but if that were to happen, that's because we've had all of this fun. We were able to fill our fun bucket and do these fun things. Now, I do have to say, like, we're also right now pricing out a new heater for our home, a new roof, and having our home painted. Well, that's not in our MDF. So those kinds of things, even though they're not, quote, fun, that's also coming out of our fun bucket because those are more than base life expenses. But they're not surprises. You know those expenses are coming. So we knew that was going to have to come out of our fun bucket. But there's still enough money there that we can go have some fun. And, you know, there's an idea that Jim and Chris talk about that I just love. They say that, you know, the idea is not to die with the most money. It's like the person with the most money at end of plan does not win. That fun money unspent is life unlived. And that's one of the things that the 4% rule doesn't really do for you.
Yeah, so I want to add to this. And so let's look at it from the other side of this. And my mother is kind of on the other side of this. She is 82 years old. She actually has a pretty decent portfolio. She does rent, so there is some more, you know, contingencies that she needs to account for because she doesn't have a home equity for long-term care. But even so, there's some excess there. And so what she has found is that she is probably in her slow-go phase at this point. She's a very active 82-year-old, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't say 82, because she's probably listening to this, so it might be 80, but she will be almost 82 when we go on the cruise. That's why it's in my head is 82, but that's 80-year-old. Sorry, Mom. But anyway, a lot of her friends, she's like planned these events, and a lot of her friends have not been able to do them at the last minute. So she's finding that she's looking back and saying, man, I should have spent more money earlier. So even this cruise, I was like, you know, she was like, boy, it's expensive. I don't know. I'm like, Mom, when are you going to do this if you don't do it now? And she's like, well, if you guys are willing to like have me tag along. And again, she's super healthy, so don't, you know, she's definitely active and be able to do everything. I was like, yes, this is when you should be doing this. What are you saving this for? There's, you know, so I think you can also talk to people that are down the road who may have not spent a lot and ask them. And this kind of goes back to Jordan's book of taking stock of talking to people. And he's a hospice doctor talking to people on their deathbed. What do they regret? And they regret not doing more things at a younger age when they could. So this is trying to kind of solve that without advantaging your future self. And that's the whole point of this kind of exercise, is to make sure your future self is taken care of, but your present self can enjoy the any excess you may have.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at this trip to Croatia. It's intergenerational family fi. It started out as a solo conference with trip with you and your daughter. And now Mom's along, Aunt Becky's along, the whole family's coming.
We may have more join up. You never know. It always can happen. You're welcome to come.
Well, that's very nice of you to invite me. I've been, but you know, I'm jealous and I do want to go again. I'm still in my working years. I'm kind of lost a little bit of autonomy that you guys have, which is pretty cool. I've just got to delay my gratification a little bit. You got to pay the bills. And working longer is one of our superpowers when we're catching up to FI. And I have to acknowledge that. So it's not all bad. I'm happy for you. It's great that your guys are going on all these trips. So at any rate, it's a good place to wrap up, actually, because Becky just told us that you've got to spend in your go-go and slow-go years. Because what was it, Becky? Money unspent is life unlived. That's right. A perfect thing to remember. That's a FIRE, financial independence, retire eventually, tagline, probably. Mark, Becky, it's been awesome being with you here today. Mark, thank you again for being co-host on so many of our shows. We'll have you back as our guest correspondent from Croatia, probably in the future, when you do a pop-up podcast for us again. And by the way, your mom must be on the show. Your mom probably should go to a Camp Fi at this point, too. It's take your mom to Camp Fi week.
I love this. I can't wait to meet Mark's mom, actually.
Well, stay tuned, because you may have already met this person, but we have this super secret special guest that'll be on the show or has already been on the show in the near future. So we hope you enjoyed that super secret special guest.
That's right. Well, thanks, Mark, for going through this with us. And I just want to make sure that folks know that if they want to, well, first, let me back up. This process, we're not saying that this is what everybody needs to do, that this is an alternative to the 4% rule. This is something that you might want to check into. It might be for you. It might not be for you. In fact, if your goal is to create the largest inheritance for your family or for a charity possible, this is not what you want to do, because this plan is going to, you know, the purpose of this is to help you spend money earlier in life while you can enjoy it. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's for everyone. But if you would like to hear more about this and learn more about it, then I would suggest folks listen to Jim and Chris. That's the Retirement and IRA Show with Jim Saulnier and Chris Stein. They publish an EDU or educational episode once a week and a Q&A episode once a week. Chris is their in-house Social Security expert, so he answers lots of questions about Social Security. I've learned a ton on Social Security and on IRAs, how they work if you inherit them. They've talked a lot recently about Secure 2.0, so they're a wealth of knowledge, and I would suggest that folks tune in and listen to Jim and Chris, and they're pretty funny guys. I think you'll enjoy it.
All right, Mark. Thanks for being here again today, buddy. It's always fun to talk to you. You're a wealth of knowledge. I look forward to seeing you both again in person soon.
Yes, thank you. And I really, really appreciate what you guys are doing. I know you're putting a lot of work into this, and it shows. So thanks again. I'm sure everyone would like to say the same to you.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.